Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Well, coming up over the next half hour, towards understanding and acceptance, how one Catholic institution is shaping tomorrow's leaders. And from rags to riches, how one young man leaves behind a childhood of terrible abuse to become a Catholic priest loved by the wealthy and the poor. Franciscan Father Michael Seed tells his story in his autobiography, Nobody's Child. Some are calling them ticking time bombs, just waiting to explode. There are some faith-based schools and schools which fail to reflect a diversity of society. Critics say they are creating veritable ethnic and religious ghettos. A recently published report on schools in Great Britain showed increasing segregation of different cultural communities. In a move to counter the trend, the British government has issued new guidelines, which all schools are expected to adopt, or risk closure, or being taken over. Schools will now be legally bound to strike up partnerships with institutions run by different faiths, so that students have an opportunity to mix with and learn with each other and about each other. It's an attempt at preventing extremism and instead promote understanding and acceptance between people of different backgrounds and faiths. Well, it's nothing new that the Catholic Church has for centuries had a primary role in educating young people in its schools and universities the world over. Most are recognized for their academic excellence and openness to people of all walks of life. One such university in the U.S. has long been working to promote interfaith and intercultural understanding, as well as the Catholic tradition of reaching out to the marginalized and the needy. Jesuit-run Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. is one of the most important and oldest Catholic educational institutions and medical centers in the United States. I recently sat down with its president, Jack DeGioia, who told me more about how the institution relies on its Catholic identity to prepare students to meet the moral and ethical challenges of this fast-changing world.
I've watched the university wrestle with lots of different challenges, questions, issues. I believe that at this moment, we have been able to find ways in which, building from the depth of our identity as a Catholic and Jesuit university, we've been able to engage our community in a set of issues, a set of themes that are so important in our world today and so important in the life of our community that there's been room for everybody at the table. We certainly don't limit the broad range of perspectives that characterize our community, but I think we've also found that there's an opportunity for every voice to find a place in the kind of questions that define this moment. And I would identify four different sets of questions that we've been wrestling with. The first, and that is our engagement in interreligious understanding. There's room for everybody in this conversation, and I don't think in any way it's been the focus of one particular set of voices over another. It's a wide range of perspectives that are offering their reflections on what it means to be engaged in interreligious dialogue. A second has been our engagement in addressing some of the significant challenges of those who have been marginalized in our world today. A defining issue for every university in the world right now is, how do we respond to the forces of globalization? And there are many ways in which Georgetown has tried to respond, and I can speak more about that in a moment. But one way in which we've tried to respond is animated by our Catholic and Jesuit identity, and that is, how do we respond to those who have been marginalized? It's a question of social justice. And our engagement, for example, in addressing the challenge of the HIV/AIDS pandemic is just one example of how we have responded to this question of social justice. A third, as the oldest Jesuit university in the United States, animated by the spirituality of St. Ignatius, we have tried to ensure that the resources of that spirituality and of other spiritualities are available to all the members of our university community. And we find that there's an incredible interest in being able to touch those resources, to tap into them, and to explore the nature of one's deepest spiritual sense. And then the last way in which we've tried to engage has been to bring the values of a Catholic and Jesuit university into engagement with the dialogue with culture. And later this fall, Cardinal Poupard will be visiting the university and offer a perspective that is grounded in his lifelong commitment to the engagement with culture.
When is that going to be?
In September. And it will be a very powerful witness for our university community as to how we bring the values of this religious tradition to bear on some of the challenges in our culture today. So in those four defining ways of engagement, we've encouraged and embraced lots and lots of voices from every conceivable perspective to bear on the questions of the day.
How do you tackle questions of gay and lesbian rights, students on campus who might be pro-abortion, you know, things that don't necessarily match up with the quote-unquote Catholic ethic?
Well, these are always among the most challenging questions that any Catholic university wrestles with. And there are some starting points for us. We first begin with a recognition that in an academic community, we foster the free exchange of ideas. And that means that we don't limit speech and expression, regardless of the content of the view being expressed or on the person expressing that point of view. And if there's any set of issues that cause the most controversy, it's usually around those who come and offer perspectives that would be counter to the position that the university would hold and that would be consistent with our Roman Catholic and Jesuit identity. But we do believe that as a university community, if we were to limit those who would be offering a perspective, even when we disagree with that perspective, we would be closing down the framework for dialogue. And we don't think we have anything to fear from the perspective of our Catholic and Jesuit identity from allowing every perspective to be heard. At the same time, we're not shy about offering our own perspective, and some of the lectures, whether it be Pacem in Terris or Nostra Aetate, have offered a very clear perspective of how, from the perspective of our Catholic and Jesuit identity, we understand some of the challenges in our world today. As a university community with one of the most significant academic medical centers, with the deepest level of life science research of any Catholic university in the world, we're very attentive to these issues. We don't perform abortions in Georgetown University Hospital. We are deeply committed to ensuring that our students are grounded in the deepest dimensions of our faith as it relates to these crucial issues of life and of human dignity.
And I would imagine the end of life as well. Euthanasia, of course, is a very important issue that we're facing in today's world.
Without question. I think if you looked at the ethos of our academic medical center at Georgetown University, you'd find it unmistakable in terms of its Catholic and Jesuit identity. You know, the most interesting set of questions that define this moment right now for a university, and for Georgetown especially, given our location, our international character, the global reach that we have as a Catholic and Jesuit university, is how we wrestle with the challenges of globalization. And there, I'll just mention a couple of things that have defined that reality for us. We've opened our first campus in another part of the world. We're in Doha, in Qatar, with our School of Foreign Service, and we've educated now, finishing the second year of our work there. We have two full classes, a sophomore class and a first-year class. These are all students from the region. About something like 20-some-odd countries are represented in the student body.
And how many students do you have there now?
Full, right now we have 60 total in the two classes. Mm-hmm. And we hope to bring in close to hopefully 40 to 50 in the class that we'll be admitting this year. We send our faculty from Washington to Doha and offer our curriculum in the School of Foreign Service to the students in the region. And our hope is that we're going to have an influence on shaping the future diplomatic corps, the folks who will be involved in international relations in the next generation right now and the work that we're doing there. At the same time, we've also been exploring ideas and opportunities in China. And while we've established very, I think, traditional kinds of relationships with Chinese universities, particularly with Renmin University in Beijing and Fudan University in Shanghai, we've also begun exploring other kinds of relationships. We've established a partnership, an academic partnership, with the Central Party School, which is a unique institution in China, which is responsible, really, for the formation of senior leadership, folks who have already established themselves on a clear trajectory of exceptional leadership. They come and spend time at the Central Party School for further development, further training. And in an American context, you might say it might be something like advanced executive training we do in our MBA programs, in our public policy programs, and even in some of our governmental programs. We've also been engaged in a number of conversations with the State Administration for Religious Affairs, exploring the future of religion in China, and how a place like Georgetown, with all the resources that we bring, our programs in the study of Jewish civilization, our program in Muslim-Christian understanding, our program in religion, politics, and peace, and our programs in theology and public policy and the like, how can these be of value in trying to explore the future of religion in China?
Where would you like to see these programs go?
Well, there are three goals, three hopes that we bring to each one of these engagements. The first is for students. Our students at Georgetown, the students that we would be engaging with in different parts of the world, can we provide them with opportunities, with experiences that they couldn't get without the development of these partnerships that would enable them to develop their promise and potential in ways that wouldn't be possible if we didn't create these new opportunities? The second is for our faculty. We want to ensure our faculty have access to opportunities which enable them to do their very best work. And then third, as a university, we want to be appropriately engaged in the world. And how can we leverage the opportunities that we have to be in different parts of the world to engage in ways that perhaps only universities can do? Mm-hmm. So, for example, the work that we're doing in addressing the HIV/AIDS pandemic, or whether it be interreligious understanding, there's some things that really only universities can do. And what we hope we can do in these partnerships is develop the framework to accomplish those goals.
What is your dream for the future of Georgetown
Sure.
University?
Well, you know, I look at the university and I see 140,000 alumni spread throughout the world. I see students coming from 139 countries. I see some of the most gifted and talented faculty that any university could ever have. I see this network of relationships that we have with some extraordinary universities throughout the world, and I see this global reach that we have by virtue of the relationship we have with Jesuit institutions throughout the world. And I see that by being in Washington, we have an opportunity to both be engaged in a dialogue, to be engaged in conversations, but to be aware of what is happening in the world in ways that I think are unique for a university. And when I look at all of those dimensions of what it means to be Georgetown, what I hope for is that we can fulfill the promise of this university to ensure that our students have the very best possible formation, that our faculty have the opportunity to do their best work, and that the university can be engaged in the world in ways in which only a place like Georgetown can be engaged, and that we fulfill our promise and potential as a university, that if there's a way in which we can help in addressing the HIV/AIDS pandemic, if there's a way in which we can foster interreligious understanding, if there's a way in which we can be engaged in the dialogue with culture through which we bring out the values of a Catholic and Jesuit university into that discourse, if we can do those things, I believe we will be coming closer and closer to fulfilling our promise. And that would be my dream for Georgetown University.
Jack DeGioia is president of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., a Jesuit-run Catholic institution. he's called the Priest of the Stars, the friend, confidant, and spiritual advisor to many of London's rich and famous. He's even been often to the British Prime Minister's household in 10 Downing Street to celebrate Mass. Franciscan Father Michael Seed is a regular visitor to Parliament and converted a number of prominent politicians to Catholicism. He also worked many years as an ecumenical aide to the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor. But although Father Michael now moves in elite circles and is known for his kindness and friendly nature, few people knew he was nobody's child from a past that led nowhere. In his inspirational new autobiography, Nobody's Child, Father Michael reveals the depths of a desperate and disturbing childhood. His alcoholic father, who mercilessly beat and poured abuse on both wife and son, driving the young boy's mother to suicide, and later bringing Michael himself to the brink of his very own self-destruction. Well, Father Michael spoke to Susie Hodges about his book and his terrifying childhood, and about how, through his faith in God, and with help from a few good people along the way, he was able to turn his life around.
From his birth onwards, Michael's childhood was blighted by what he describes as pitiless brutality. His mother was a poor, unmarried teenager who gave Michael up for adoption as a baby. His adoptive father was a sadistic alcoholic who beat, tortured, and sexually abused the young Michael. His adoptive mother suffered from depression, and after many failed suicide attempts, she eventually killed herself by jumping off a railway bridge when Michael was 8. Not long afterwards, his father died as well, and Michael was sent to a school for maladjusted children, where he gradually found his way towards religion. Father Michael spoke to me about what led him to delve back into the details of this painful childhood with this book.
The book is not written, it's spoken. It took me about 30 days of speaking it into a recorder with my good friend Noel Botham. And Noel very faithfully transcribed my words. And so the book is really like listening to a radio program.
Was it quite painful, but at the same time quite therapeutic to come out and to, shall we say, confront once again all the appalling things that happened to you in your childhood?
It was immensely therapeutic. It made me relive scenes as in a cinema. Also, I needed, I think, to get these things out because I had never addressed them ever, and I think I needed to be done. I had to dramatically edit it because often we say things that we regret. Well, I certainly have. In the book I say, you know, am I happy this has come out? I'm not entirely. It has, and I hope that it will serve to help people. It's been written bluntly, or too bluntly in my opinion, and it has kept its brutality. I just hope it will help other people to live happy and a normal life.
Many people who experienced all the appalling things that you experienced would grow up at the very least emotionally dysfunctional, possibly criminal, violent, and maybe an abuser themselves, because that often happens. How come you didn't?
I can't answer that. It's very difficult. I think if you experience these things, you can go, as you said, you can go either way. I think I chose to look upon life once I decided to live and not indeed take my own life. I therefore wanted to enjoy it in a sense, if I could. Possibly. Now, that didn't really happen until I was 17, 18, really, that I actually could say that I actually started to live. I don't think I'd lived before then, because life was just gruesome. I mean, 3 times decided to end it.
After spending much of his childhood wanting to kill himself, Father Michael says he gradually rose up from the depths of despair after being helped by an inspirational teacher at his special school who helped him find God.
The main person, I would say, was this teacher called Stanley Thomas, who was the deputy head of my school in Rochdale. This was from the age of 12 to 16, this kind of children's home school mentioned in the book, not a very nice place. But he arrived, and he was a Church of England priest, and it was he really that introduced me to a deeper faith, and which led me to become a member of the Church of England briefly, and ultimately led me back to the church of which I was baptized as a Catholic. And there we are. So Stanley Thomas was probably my greatest mentor I've ever had in life. He looked after me from the age of 13 to about 16 when I left the school. He introduced me to so many different things of the beauty of life, of classical music, of art, of so many things, philosophy, theology, all these ones, and indeed enticed me to start reading, which I wasn't really capable of. So he was a great man.
You tried many religions, though, before you actually came to be received in the Catholic Church. What actually was it that brought you to Catholicism in the end?
Well, I always was technically a Roman Catholic, as I discovered at the age of 16 that I had been baptized as one as a little child. But my grandmother was Salvation Army, and we went there as a little child. Then we became strict in particular Baptist, quite Protestant. And I was very moved by them, by the healthy form of fundamentalism, you know, the scriptural integrity and ethics and various things. It gave me a way to live and a very good sense of God with them. But unfortunately, they had nothing to do with anybody else. Other Baptists were considered heretical, and Methodists were, and Church of England was, but Catholics would be considered absolutely outrageous. So I lived an isolated little world as a strict Baptist, and then I just felt I was growing up. I realized the world was much more universal, and ideas and whatever. And so meeting Mr. Thomas at my school is basically the one who pointed me in the direction of the Catholic Church, even though I didn't know it at the time. He was quite a high Anglican, and he introduced me to sacraments. Then when I left school, I went to this Anglican church, and I went to talk to this Anglican priest who said that I really was a Roman Catholic, even though I was baptized a Baptist at 15. He asked me, was I baptized as a baby? And I said, yes, as a Catholic. So he demanded that I be received into the Church of England from the Catholic Church, which made me very annoyed because I didn't consider myself a Catholic. I considered myself a Baptist. So he did it, and then I wasn't happy with it. And he gave me a course between the differences of the Church of England and the Catholic Church, and he was so anti-Catholic that he actually produced an interest in me in Catholicism. So I went straight over the road to the Catholic Church, and there you are. That's what happened. So it's quite funny that I was provoked to become a Catholic by an Anglican priest, a negative one.
So does he feel that having known so much suffering as a child helps make him a better priest?
It might make me in some ways a worse priest. I'm not sure if it does actually make you a better one. I don't know. Every human life has its strengths and its weaknesses. I suppose if there are any strengths, it does help you to value the virtue of life, of every minute we have and every second and every breath. This is a very valuable item of what we do with it. And so I think a highly sensitive level when people, particularly when people are suffering. I can sense it very much indeed because I've been through much, and so I suppose it does help. And that's for other people to judge. It's not for me. I mean, in some ways, I might think that I would be an inadequate, overly emotional character. Now, I don't know whether that's a strength or not. I mean, there are some people who don't have any emotion. I probably have too much. So I admire people who actually have, you know, less emotion than I do because they tend to be more effective.
In many ways, what you've achieved is miraculous. As you say, you went to a special school, yet I gather that you now have 3 university degrees and 2 doctorates. Was it quite a revelation to discover that perhaps after an unpromising beginning that you actually had a very good brain and were able to use it?
A very good brain. Yes, I suppose it is. But the great problem was that I couldn't do education in the normal sense, but I was able to speak. So I was given permission to do all my exams spoken, and I went from failing all my things to passing because I'm blessed with a very good memory. And to this day, I never use notes ever. All my sermons are spoken from my mind, and all my lectures and talks are all from my mind.
Fortunately, Father Michael has left the brutality and deprivation of his childhood a long way behind him and is now a well-known priest who counts the British Prime Minister Tony Blair and other celebrities among his friends. So how did he get to know the Prime Minister and his family in the first place?
Well, how I got to know them, it was in 1993, an event for the homeless. It was through that mainly, and through mutual friends of theirs, and that's how we met. Very lovely people and a very loving family. It's been a privilege to know them. Of course, they are parishioners, or they have been parishioners for 10 years now with us.
So when you go to Downing Street, you're celebrating Mass there?
Well, according to the newspapers, yes. And yes, I do. I have. That is correct. That's true. But anyway, as I say, I mean, they're very fine, very good people. And it's been a privilege to help them while they have been here. And I hope in the future.
But you obviously are a person that's able to feel comfortable both with somebody who's a celebrity and also with a down and out. Is that true?
I would hope so. Otherwise, we might as well close up the church. Of course, we have to relate to everybody. And I think, again, it goes that perhaps is a gift. And I'm grateful for that. I think the question is, if you do relate to people, whoever they are, you just treat people as they are. And you mustn't show differences or be fazed by them. And I think that's probably, I hope, one of the gifts that I have. As people, I do treat people the same, and they're normal. We all have to do the same things in our life, and we are all the same, basically. I'm not a communist, but I am. I do think that there is an equality to everyone.
The proceeds from his book will be given to a number of charitable causes, but Father Michael says the primary aim of his book is to help other people in difficult situations.
The most important thing is not the number of books that go out, I mean, it would be for the publisher. It's more if its interest will help people, and I think it will, and I'm very happy for that. I've written it in a very honest way, and I hope it will be popular. Of course I do. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the end of the book has God at the beginning as well, but it does have a sense that of the Creator and the value of life and to preserve it. So the actual book ends at the age of 17, just before my 17th birthday. And then there's a very, very brief epilogue that takes you to my mid-20s. It takes you to my final vows as a friar and my ordination. So it doesn't go beyond the last, really, 25 years.
And when you say it ends at 17, was that really when you found religion and this is where you found God?
Yes, it's when I left school, and I go to work in a homeless centre with the elderly. But it's yes, it does. The religious journey starts there. Yes, it does. And so the epilogue is hope, a pleasant spiritual journey. And God is also very much mentioned around the later part of the book.
That was Father Michael Seed talking about his autobiography, Nobody's Child. And I'm Susie Hodges.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.